Hi, I'm Chad Hughes, and you're listening to Elevated Access, the inside story. This episode, I met with Sandy Grigg, a property acquisition expert who has been securing access for some of the most complex infrastructure projects in North America. He provides insight into how he changed the heavy hand perception that sometimes precedes project developers. He shares practical guidance for successful access outcomes and principles like respect for the owner, being reasonable, and working with, not against. He even shares tips for managing project developer expectations. Let's tune in to the conversation with Sandy. Our guest today is Sandy Grigg. Sandy has been working in the field of access for 45 years, the first 30 in public sector real estate, working for Ontario Power Generation and Ontario Hydro, and the last 15 as a consultant, specializing in public sector real estate and related management services. His background includes the full spectrum of real estate activities such as property acquisition, project and asset management, expropriation, dispute resolution, project planning and management functions. His experience comes from utility, municipal, provincial, and major transit infrastructure projects. Sandy has authored several IRWA courses and textbooks and has made presentations across Canada on such topics as advanced project planning and project delivery, and expropriation from a negotiator perspective. He is the past chair of the IRWA International Professional Development Committee and past IRWA International President. Sandy, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's always interesting to talk about the profession that we both seem to enjoy and love.
Absolutely. There are no shortage of stories in this field of work, and we're going to lean into some of those today. So let's start with your background. Tell our audience a little bit about your background, how you got started in this career of access.
Well, nobody ever applies to get into this job. The job seems to find people are totally unexpecting this kind of work. And actually, a lot of people don't even understand what this work is like and what it means and what it does. My first introduction to that is starting with the utility, Ontario Hydro, as a clerk in the property department. And it was from there I started to get some interest in what the people were doing. And the thing is, you would be in the office doing the admin functions, and then at the beginning of the week, all the field guys would be coming in, one, to get expense accounts done and to get new assignments and so forth like that. And they were really interesting. And you'd hear a lot of stories about, adventures or occurrences that happened on the road. So I started taking classes, starting off with title searching, just to understand the business. And then I went into taking appraisal courses, just to understand how the appraisal courses work and to advance in this organization. So after several years, there was an opportunity to join a management training program, which was another name for saying we need people in the field. If you understand the size of Ontario, getting people to, you don't build transmission lines in the city of Toronto. So they needed people experienced and qualified to basically travel the province. And I got selected for that. The training was amazing because what they did is they made us work in every single department in the property department, property management, acquisition, taxation, into the regions, all this stuff to get a sense of the organization and the function. And then I got sent out on my first training assignment with a major project where I did a lot of the clerical stuff. And it's sort of a funny story to start is I had worked as an expropriation clerk with Ontario Hydro for a while. When we went out to see some owners. This was down in the Belleville region. There were some people that hadn't been served notices. So because I had the background, one of the older, more refined agents said, look, why don't you go out and explain to this person the expropriation? So being young and naive, I said, sure. So I go out and talk to him. And when I came back, I was told that it doesn't matter because he was legally incompetent anyway. So I went to the guy that gave me the assignment and I basically said, thanks a lot for doing that. And he said, if you can explain it to him, you can explain it to anybody. So that was sort of one of my first experiences with an owner. So other than that, it was from there, you get the urge to carry on and to interact with people. At first, I was concerned that I thought I just wanted to appraise. This way you don't have to interact with people and, just do some numbers and then you can walk away from it. But the more you get involved with people, the better it is. On the same project, there was a guy out there called 3-Hour Jesse. And when you went to talk to him, it was a minimum 3 hours. And at the end of the day, you finally learned to realize it was a lonely old guy that lived alone and just craved the company. So every now and then I would just make sure I gave him a call and say, look, I'm dropping by, you got time to talk. And, and he would not accept or negotiate because that mean it would be over, So eventually I had to get to the point and say, Jesse, you may have won the battle, but you're going to lose the war, but that doesn't mean we won't keep coming around. Right. So at the end of the day, one of those things you'll always remember. And getting him to sign that deal was I still remember that because he came out and pulled out this, and of course you weren't allowed to drink on the job, but he pulled out this old rot gut, whatever it was, and he said, we don't do a deal unless we have a toast. So I took the chance, and again, it was just, since then there have been no dull moments, and every day is a new day. And you learn something new every day when you interact with people. It's that simple.
Yeah. Early on, when you started to get more exposure to that landowner interaction, the people part, what surprised you about, the things that really drew you into that focus as opposed to pursuing the appraisal?
Well, I think that anybody that does this business are people persons anyway. They like to talk and hear stories and listen to other people and see how they are. But I really felt when I went out with people, I could connect with them and be able to see their side. It gets down to a lot of the work we do, and to be frank and to be honest, is if we don't come to an amicable settlement, that project's going through anyway. It's going to get built. So it was more of a case that helped develop the philosophy is that my role is to be fair to both my employer and this owner, but to make sure that, he was treated carefully, respectfully, and honestly. And it's just doing that has just helped me all the way through my career.
Earlier in your career, at what point did they start to emerge for you where you started to notice that you were taking on a certain perspective or philosophy in the work you were doing, or philosophies coming out of the work you were doing and experiences you were having? What point did that start to happen for you?
I think actually it started early in the project is when I got out there, and the more you interact with people in these situations, you understand it's not all about the money. And it's about the issues and resolving the issues and the fact that you are, in essence, a heavy hand. I guess that's one way to look at it. But I would go into a farm, and I went into this one farm. He was a dairy farmer, and he took me into the barn. And it was the cleanest building I'd ever seen because he took a lot of pride into that. And then he would come out and say and show me, look, this is what you're doing to me. Not negatively, but he was saying, here's an issue I have. So what it got down to is, let's solve the issues first. Let's understand the issues. Let's empathize on the issues. And then once we get those out of the way, then we can talk dollars and cents. And I think taking that approach led to, you know, better deals being taken and amicable agreements, and hopefully providing a good reputation to my organization as well, mm-hmm. saying, hey, we're not just here to do a job.
Mm-hmm. It's such a relational profession. And you know, what comes to mind when you describe that is just the importance of building that rapport and the trust. And it's hard to build rapport when you're talking about money. And so the upfront listening and understanding people's perspectives and how they perceive the impact on them, you know, is really, really such a key piece of building that kind of rapport.
Well, you know, Chad, when you sort of tie this into an early access issue, because this is when I just started out when I was young and fresh, is I had two properties that we had the legislated right to go on the property, and the owners had said, you're not getting on. So part of the relationship building was spending hours on the phone explaining what was going to happen, how it was going to happen, and that when it did happen, I would be out right in front.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be the one standing out there, that I wasn't going to talk and hide behind anybody else. This was my job. I was bringing it in. And so, you know, it was a little scary. I mean, I was still pretty young, and it was called a forced entry. But at the end of the day, we got it resolved. We got in. And that did two things for me. It's number one, the word got out that, you know, I did what I said I would do. So that was number one. But the offshoot benefit of that is the construction people and all the other people that do the project saw that we stood up, the realty guys stood up, got it done, and that they could count on us to get it done, which built that relationship.
Yeah, that goes a long way. It's also quite rewarding too, when you're the cause of that effect.
Well, and you don't get shot. I mean, that's a real big bonus too, is you're not getting shot or beat up or something like that. That's a bonus.
Yeah. there is the odd story. I do recall one time having a hammer waved in my face. It was a very awkward moment. Not that there was anything I could have done to actually prevent that, but we worked our way through it and I survived that. But tell us a little bit about some of the past projects that you've done in terms of maybe complexity and, you know, maybe how some of those projects have influenced your thinking around the topic of access today.
Well, I think the first one is the high voltage lines. And that was basically what we've been talking about in the past, because they're, we'd had a right, we'd expropriated the right to enter, but there's sometimes the entrance was denied. And I think that's where I learned the other thing is in respecting with the owner, is because we wanted access. But sometimes they took the construction wanted the easiest access. In other words, right through the middle of a field. They were going to go in and dig up all the topsoil and that, and then put it back later, which from, you know, and this is the things you learn when dealing with the agricultural community. There are certain things you can't do, whereas you can say to them, can you not do your access following the outside of the fields or on the edge of the field rather than crossing? And if you're going to cross in the middle, can you do it in a straight line? Because agricultural people deal in squares, not angles. So, you know, little things like that, you learn that. And so I was taking that on further with me. And then I got involved in some other problems in what we call in Ontario, the near north and the Sudbury area, that where we were building, taking a right of way for two transmission lines. And it was interesting because, first of all, the only ways you could inspect the property where you're going to acquire was by helicopter. So that was a new experience for me as well, as to be able to see it. And even though I was doing some appraisals, you couldn't even inspect the sales because they were in the bush. So part of the access issues we had, especially in that one, is one of the problems that came up is that the access that they had planned on didn't work. So they needed new access right away. And I went to see the guy about the access, and he agreed to the access, but only if we paid cash up front. So the issue for me is, you've got to remember, this is back in the 80s and sort of a, you know, just a young guy with a young family, and you're dealing with a government agency who doesn't have a petty cash drawer. So at the end of the day, anyway, I worked it out, was able to come up with the $1,000 and go up and gave the guy the cash, and then he signed it. So we got in right away. But it was quite interesting that nobody ever since has asked for cash. So there was that. And part of the other access problems was terrain. Getting access into some of these areas in the mid-north, where you had true Canadian Shield and access, so your access might be fairly distant from the corridor itself. So just even trying to figure out who owned it, and coming to the realization that not only were you going to get access, but you're going to have to cut down a lot of trees, and you're going to have to build a road. And one of the issues that came up with one owner is, okay, if we let you do this, you've got to restore it, because we do not want people coming in. Because the problems in the nearer north are hunters coming in and using whatever easy access they can. So, you know, there's that kind of scenario. And then it brings you back up again to some of the stuff that's going on today. A lot of the work is in downtown Toronto. So the largest city in Canada. So when you're going into, there's a difference between accessing an agricultural field and then accessing a bush lot, to then having to go into someone's backyard or into somebody's business. So the whole dynamic changes again. So you have to understand, what issues am I going to run into? And the best way to do that is to ask the owner and just say, look, this is what we need to do. This is what we'd like to do. How can we do it? What do you suggest? You know, and in some cases, the proponent would give you a sketch of the whole property. Okay, we want to get in. We're going to do boreholes, or we're going to do birds, bats, and fauna, you know, inspections. So the first thing you need to be very clear with an owner is, are you going to be looking at intrusive or non-intrusive? Because if it's just a walkabout versus bringing in machinery, those are two different aspects and require two different sort of touches when you deal with them. The second thing is security of the owner's property. Especially if it's a business, some of these are access controlled and some of them are sensitive sites. And there's one building we had to get into the back of it, but it had transport trucks coming in hourly, and is sometimes even more frequent than that. So being in the back, and there were blind spots, making sure, one, that everybody was protected, and two, that there were spotters. So these are the kind of just the little things you go and, you know, you go and find out. And just basic respect as to, mm-hmm. where do you want us to go? And how can we do that? It's not a case of saying, can we do it? You have to sort of position as saying, we need to do this. So how can we do this? You know, and part of the other part as well is how you document it, because of course you're going to, you know, pay for damages and things like that. But, you know, you have to be taking the philosophy that if it's worth talking about, it's worth writing down. So if you're going to present an access document, you have to check and make sure it's not all one-sided either. So I have seen them where they ask for access to the whole property. The location for intrusive work is done without inspecting the site. So an example of that is a friend of mine had to get access because they were going to do boreholes. Well, the boreholes was on a golf course, and the boreholes were going to be in the green, but nobody had been out to see that. So can you imagine the damage? Well, first of all, as golfers, Chad, like, it's this, you know, how dare you even go near a green? Just the fact, right, what it would take to cure,
yeah,
that problem, you know, it's so... So at the end of the day, it gets down to you want something from them. They did not ask you there. So the philosophy, again, comes back down to respect for the owner and be reasonable and work with, not against, you know, those individuals to get what you need.
I'm curious to know about the transition from more of that rural access type work to the urban work. At what point in your career did you start to transition to where you're dealing in more densely populated areas, or was it like that from the outset?
Initially, the majority of work I had with the utility, with Ontario Hydro, was in more remote communities, either in Northern Ontario or in the agricultural community and so forth. And as I transitioned towards, retiring from Ontario Hydro and I went out on my own, it was only urban settings. So it wasn't a shock because the principles are the same. That, you know, you need to, the difference get down to that in an urban setting, your properties are smaller. There's a greater chance for impact on the owner and the owner's use, you know, getting access on a property where you take out parking spots. That is a problem. So it's the same principles that you would apply, whether it was agricultural, urban, or wilderness, is what's the problem? What do you want to do? You know, find out what the impacts are to the owner and then go out and verify those impacts. And if the owner says, this is really going to mess me up, don't be afraid to say, geez, yeah, it will. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with it? But the spots are so much smaller in sense and more intense. Access to people's backyards, like residential properties, that's difficult. And sometimes you have to make allowances there by saying, we're not going to come through your property. We'll come in from the back. And most of those are resolved because I was working on linear corridors. So you could access from the back. But the issue again, okay, if you're going to come to the fence, how are you going to fix the fence? Are you going to fix it right away? What kind of things are you doing? If you're going to dig boreholes in somebody's backyard, you now need, in an urban center, protection around the hole. Because somebody might have kids or might have, if it's a business, might have workers going out there. And the last thing you want to do is step in like a gopher hole. Because then that just creates issues for everybody. So it's again, analyzing the situation. And the agriculture situation is just as complex as the urban. It's just that it may take more to solve the urban one, but the principle doesn't change.
Yeah. I often have looked at the urban type of work that you're doing as being more complex, but when you put it that way, and I guess strip it back to the basic principles of what works.
The issue, Chad, I think is when you draw it back to the basic principles, and the principal problem solving for anything to do with our business is who, what, why, when, where, how. If you answer those questions, because first of all, you should answer them up front because the owner is going to ask you them. What is it you're doing? When are you doing it? Where are you doing it? Who's doing it? Why are you doing it? And how are you doing it? If you can deal with that. So that's that problem technique applies to everything. Agricultural, urban, wilderness. It's all the same. It's just the answers you get back is how you deal with the information you get.
What comes to mind, if you think back over your career, as one of the most difficult negotiations you've ever had?
I don't think it's possible to narrow it down because you get the person that you want to deal with that's, you know, very cooperative and so forth and, you know, don't want to impose on you. And it's just making sure that they don't do something that they'll regret later. Okay, in other words, that's part of the fairness principle. And an example of that is one of those forced entries that I wasn't involved in back in the early days, is the owner came out and got very, very upset, you know, that we were coming in. And at the end of the day, he found out that he didn't have all the information about what we were doing. And he fired his lawyer and came back, and he was so apologetic to us. He said, I'll sign your deal. And we said, no. I said, we're going to do a deal, but we're going to do the right deal that you buy in as well, not just because you're feeling bad because you did whatever actions you took, right? So I think that, but I think the things that I remember the most is I was on a project in Toronto at Georgetown Up Express. And before I took on a leadership role, I had 9 houses to buy on one street. And the last house right next to the railroad, when I went in there, the homeowner basically said to me, you're going to see scratch marks on the wall as you drag me out of this house. So that was a problem that had its challenges. But suffice it to say, it worked out. And getting a deal like that was just so satisfying. Is that just to take that a little bit further, when we went through this was not in one of the better areas of the city. When we went to meet to discuss things, we would meet in the Tim Hortons because it was more of a safe, secure, open location. And we would do our discussions there. And when we finally came up, because when you move a house, when you move somebody out, when you take somebody's, first of all, you don't take somebody's house, you take somebody's home. And you have to look at it that way. How would you want to be treated? So at the end of the day, she had found another property for her family. And on the day that she was supposed to firm up the purchase, I was actually in Las Vegas with the right-of-way, and she called me. And she said, I don't know if this is right. So I said, then we don't do it, we'll start over. I said, you think about it and you make the decision. I said, I can't make it for you, but if you do not feel comfortable, don't do it. Well, didn't she phone me about 2 hours later, pull me out of the meeting again, and she said, no, I think it's a home. So she didn't want a house, she wanted a home. Okay. So when you get the calls like that, and they are just, you know, appreciative about the way they were treated, you know. So at the end, those are the kind of deals that I like. You can get deals with big corporations and large money deals and all that stuff. And those are fine to get because that's an accomplishment. But finding those ones that have an impact on people and yourself. Yeah,
that's big. There's some big emotional components around something like that. And I think when I think of the urban property acquisition, that's the reason I sort of default to it being more complex, because you are in some cases taking somebody's home and they're having to relocate as a result of that project. And I think it's just a fine art in managing that relationship through the process. You know, there's another stakeholder type that we often deal with aside from a property owner or a community, and that's the proponent that wants to develop the project. And you know, I recall, and this still exists today, that we sometimes spend just as much time negotiating and navigating those relationships as we do the external ones. How do you deal with that? Like, what there's a balance there between pleasing the proponent and, you know, and being a buffer, I suppose. How do you manage it?
Well, I think the first thing, it's always been my philosophy in the right of way and some of the stuff I've written, is that a project is not silos. Okay. You don't have the proponent, you don't have the realty, you don't have this. It is a level playing field where the work evolves. And there are times in the project life cycle when the realty is more important because, you know, we all need to understand. And this is what I tell proponents all the time. You're not getting on until you have the right. It's that simple. you know, and if we don't work it out, then it will be delayed for whatever the legislative time is. And I remember being in, but you see a lot of the people in proponents, they just think, well, real estate, everybody's bought a house, every maybe leased an apartment or something like that, just how easy it is. And they don't realize one, it's difficult when you take somebody's whole property, but it is even more difficult when you only take a piece of it. So having to understand the ups and downs of that. And I remember on this project, the Toronto one that I was on, the Up Express Georgetown, is that there was a lot of forming and storming with the proponents and the project delivery team at the start. And as we moved along, it was probably one of the greatest teams I've ever worked on. Whereas we would have the property guys talk directly to the field guys. In other words, you didn't have to go to a meeting, ask somebody a question, they would pass it on, get the answer. It's sort of like the Boy Scout thing, right? You start at one end and the other, and you don't get the right answer regardless. And it got into that it really worked well as a team. And I'll give you two examples. Is one, we were in a meeting and they were dealing with a bridge crossing a river. And one of the engineers was giving me advice on how to acquire real estate. And I said, there's two things you need to understand here. I said, number one, I have built three sheds that are all level. They do not leak. So if you need some help in building this bridge, give me a call so I can help you with that. And I said, the second thing is if we don't work together on this, the only thing you're building is shelving from IKEA. So, you know, but that was the kind of interactions that would work. And at the same type of meeting, one of the guys came back and said, we're well into this project. It had a definitive deadline. It had an immovable deadline. And he said, if we don't get on this property within the next 2 weeks, the crews are going to be pulled out. We're going to start losing money and we won't make the date. So in the meeting, basically what we said was, okay, we're no longer doing property acquisition. We're getting you on. I said, as long as you support, we'll get you on. And I talked to some of the best guys that I've worked with and that were on my team. And I said, how do we get them on? And we did. We got them on. But we didn't say, okay, well, the rule says you can only pay $1 here. You can only do that. The goal then was to get them building. So being flexible and showing the team that you have their interest at heart as well without and understanding this, the proponent will push you.
Yeah.
No matter what, he will push you in all kinds of different directions. Turning it into a real integrated team is what happens. And that was one of the best teams I've ever worked on.
So many relational dynamics in this kind of work. There's a lot happening in the GTA with infrastructure development, a lot of government funding that's there to support, and probably some of the biggest projects there in a long, long time. I've heard $28 billion. I've heard $38 billion, but big numbers. Tell us a little bit about what is happening in the GTA. What is this infrastructure spending going towards?
Well, I think the $28 billion you're referring to are the four subway lines that Toronto, or that Metrolinx, who is the provincial transit agency arm and tied into the Ministry of Transportation, they're building what's called the Ontario Line, which is sort of a west to northeast line to help relieve the existing subways that are overcrowded. And it's going to run basically from the Exhibition Stadium. It's going to come up, run through downtown. It's going right through Queen and Yonge, which is down at the heart of Toronto, and then it's going to come back south and swing up to Eglinton, where the Science Center is, and it's going to tie into an LRT that is just being finished there. So that's one. There's what's called the Scarborough subway extension, which is a three-stop subway coming from the east end of the existing subway line, and it's turning north to Upper Scarborough. There's the Eglinton West. So it's an LRT that's going to head west from its depot at West End, Toronto. It's going to head out towards the airport. And then there's the extension of the existing subway line that runs north-south in Toronto that's going up into York Region. So that's about, that's just four of the projects. What else is going on? And these are all being done by one provincial agency, Metrolinx, which I predicted back in 2010 that they would become the Ministry of Transportation of Transit. And that seems to be because they're controlling the subway stuff. But their commuter rail network on all their corridors is being upgraded so that they will go two-way all-day service. They will be going out as far as Kitchener, Guelph. They'll be going north to Barrie. That's huge because they're expecting to take a huge number of cars off Highway 400. It's going on the Lakeshore east and west. They're expanding. It'll eventually service Niagara Falls and even out west past Oshawa to Clarington, Bowmanville. So this is all interrelated. And then this commuter rail, not only is it going to go two-way all-day service, in some areas it's going to be two-way all-day 15-minute service, which is a dramatic change. And it's one of the reasons why I started taking the train going downtown instead of driving, because if it was 15-minute service, like it was a no-brainer. My wife spent $30 to park when I can go downtown for $3. Part of that as well is it's all going to be electrified. So that's part of the whole new issues that we have to deal with as well as electrifying these rail corridors. And at the centerpiece of this is the Toronto Union Station, because that's the hub. All the rail corridors come in and out of that one spot. So we're doing massive work there as well. So when you want to talk about complexity, heavy urban centers, partial takings, buying out, relocating businesses, in some cases, one or two properties where we're affecting and having to relocate over 50 tenants. You know, that is a sort of a new thing as well in the urban center is relocating businesses. And when you're in Toronto, you can imagine the cost and the price. So that's how this $28 billion number gets high fast, you know. So it's very, very complex from a real estate standpoint. It just gets, you know, the more complex it gets, the easier it is to deal with, believe it or not, because once you've seen it once, what you learn, some of the things that I learned on the agricultural properties and in the northern properties spill over onto these things as well. That's, and you brought this up, it's the relationship thing and so forth like that. But it's really working hard to get it done. And this is the only business I know where the people that do it never say, I don't have an answer. What they will say is, I don't have an answer yet, but we will find one. We will solve this problem. And that's the nature of this business. And that's the nature of the people that do this kind of business. And these are all the things you learn. So when I have a problem, for example, in a right-of-way training, you learn to read, you know, engineering drawings and maps, right? So that's fine. You know, I can read this map. I can use a scale and all that stuff. When I started working down at Union Station, we're dealing with a building that has five strata levels. So just even trying to figure out the plans. So I learned something new, and then I could take that and translate that out, you know, and things that were unusual before, I now deal with air rights. Even though I don't look 39, you know, it's these are the new things that you continue to learn. And then how do you deal with them? In a lot of cases, I don't know, but we'll figure it out. But we won't figure it out alone. That's the key. So in our business, and Chad, I'm sure you do this, you have people you reach out to and say, well, have you seen this? Or what do you think of that? Or something like that. I have that calls like that every day.
Let's lean into that a little bit. Like with that, the magnitude of these projects, and I'm not sure all our listeners would be familiar with the GTA. If you pull out a map and look at it, it's dense, and almost hard to imagine how some of these things could be fit in to the existing infrastructure. But from an access perspective, like and you're dealing with this currently, you're boots on the ground on some of this work. What are the challenges looking like? Are they, you know, I think challenges can be a wide spectrum in the work we do. The challenge can be the timing expectations of a proponent. They can be to do with routing. It can be to do with just stakeholder or property owner opposition. What are you dealing with? What do the headwinds look like? I assume there's plenty of headwinds.
Well, there's always headwinds. So it just depends on how you set your sail, I guess, how you're going to get through it. Some of the areas like in downtown Toronto, we're not even dealing with the money and that issues. We're dealing now with major buildings that are commercial buildings and, you know, retail buildings and so forth like that. And we're going to have to start relocating infrastructure. We're going to have to start cutting off access, and we're going to have to start digging holes in major streets. So if you could ever think of things like the subway that I'm dealing on right now, the Ontario Line, is going along Queen Street. So they're going to have to shut down Queen Street to get down there to, one, not only dig the tunnel, but they have to relocate all that infrastructure. So whatever province you're in, take your biggest city, take us your most active, expensive corner in your city, and decide we're going to put a subway there. And all these utilities are going to move. Plus, there's the issue of when you're in an urban center, pedestrian flow. How are these people going to get around if you start blocking the streets off? How are people going to access these retail and business facilities? So that's sort of the kind of problem we look at. And again, it all gets down into partnerships with, and the partnerships must include the property owner. Mm-hmm. It's that simple. It's not just a case we're going to build here and it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. It has to be done collaboratively. So the one principle, again, and the other principle that I always like to look at when dealing, especially when it's complex, is collaborative, cooperative, and communicative. And that will get you through it. Because in some of these things that I'm dealing with now, Chad, to be honest, I don't know how we're going to do them. Mm-hmm. We're going to do them. I just don't know how yet.
I hope our city is, Perez proposed what they call the Green Line here in Calgary. And there'll be some tunneling done to support that. I hope they reach out to some of the experience in Toronto, because there's plenty of it, and there's probably lots to learn from the work you're doing there. Let's talk about. I want to leave our audience with some good takeaways, and so. Question I have, and this where we'll start with this, is common mistakes. What are some of the common mistakes that you see proponents making when they are, well, at any point in the project, whether it's the upfront design or the actual, when they're into the acquisition process, or maybe even during construction? What stands out to you as common mistakes that proponents make?
Well, I you know, there's several, and one of them is being a lack of understanding of the acquisition function itself. And what's really important is to understand what kind of time it takes. So, for example, if you're going to buy a house, so you buy the house, you have a period of time, you know, before you firm up. And then you close and move. So what's that, 60, 90 days, something like that. So how much, and that's what a lot of proponents think. Okay, we're going to do here and we're going to, you know, get the property by this time, and then we're going to be able to work. But they don't have any understanding the amount of time it takes to get to the point of making that offer and what needs to be required. They, you know, okay, we're going to get surveys. Well, okay, the kind of surveys, you got to make sure you're surveying the right thing. So in order to do the surveys and move a project forward, the proponent has to provide a clear definition of what it is they want. And I think that's a hard part for them, especially with some of these new procurement processes that go on, where you acquire to a certain point on a reference concept design, and then you leave the remainder for the project company to do that. So, you know, sometimes getting a clear definition of what they want and when timing and a definition of requirement is there. So one of the things we always look at in, at least in Ontario, at least on these projects, is if you have to expropriate, theoretically, you can only expropriate your minimum requirement. So some proponents will say, well, we'll buy this, we'll buy that. And, oh, yeah, like we can try and buy it amicably. But if you cannot support needing to take that full property right, then you'll have to expect a lesser right. So that's where it gets in, is that they don't bring the real estate in, I think, soon enough to have these discussions. And what you do with a proponent is what you do preparing for an owner. What do you want? When do you want it? Where do you want it? Who's going to do it? Why do you want it? And how are you going to do it? Because this way will then help you. Because what will happen is some proponents may say, okay, we're going to get the property to do this. And the questions that the real estate people ask is, well, how are you going to get to this? Are you going to need access? Are you going to need temporary rights? Oh, yeah, but we'll get those later. Well, you know, all of a sudden, what you have to do is protect the proponent as well from putting your organization into a bad leverage situation. And so by working with them to clearly understand what the actual timings are to get what they need, and then to be clear with their definition of what it is they want. And part of that is how they're going to do that. Because when you, for example, if somebody says, I only want an easement. Well, the prevailing value for easements, everybody says, okay, it's 50%. Well, the value depends on the use. Okay, if the use is intense, it may be greater than 50%. It could be 95%. If you, you know, and like, in other words, what is the residual left that the owner can do? So these are the kind of questions you need to understand, because, so this is how it ticks in. You find it what they want. So now you have something to go and share with the appraisers, saying, okay, this is what they want, and this is how it's going to be used, which will affect the value. And then you take that information, what the appraiser comes up, and then you speak to the lawyers and say, okay, these are the kind of documents and the things we need to look at and some of the conditions. Because I'm sure anybody that's done this business knows all documents are not the same. So that's so just a simple fact of knowing when do you want it, what do you want, and a lot of things is how are you going to do what you want to do. That's really big. Again, that goes back to that access for the golf course. Oh, we're just going to take some boreholes. Well, how are you going to do that? Well, we're going to bring in a tracked vehicle. Well, all of a sudden, that's a little different than some guy with a shovel, right, digging down. You know, it just gets down that way. And being cognizant throughout the process that the real estate is a living thing and that the proponent needs to have a relationship with an owner. So if they, on an access, here's an access issue that comes up. The organizations will, you know, get a constructor in to come in and do whatever he's going to do with their due diligence. And then, you know, they say, you know, they'll look after damages. But what happens if the constructor doesn't do the damages correctly or something like that? You can't go back to a proponent and say there's all these damages are yours. And they go, oh, no, that was the contractor's problem. You know, at the end of the day, it's got to be clear that, hey, it's your project. You're responsible for the contractor. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for what they do or do not do. So, and I've actually been out with one of my colleagues on a site where a constructor was using somebody's land to store pallets. The problem was we only had subsurface rights. Mm. And so the owner complained about that. So the first thing we did, and we knew the proponent, is him and I went out to the property, got a hold of the construction guy and said, you got, you know, 2 hours to get this off this property or this stuff now belongs to him because you're trespassing. So, you know, at the end of the day, it gets back to communicate, collaborate, and collaborate. But the biggest issue with a proponent is time. and understanding what they want. And at times they're not sure what they want. And you help them figure that out.
That's good.
When you understand what it is they want to do.
Time, what I'm hearing you say is give yourself adequate time. That involves some upfront planning, I think, and be clear. Be clear on what you need and what you want and where you're going and how are you going to go about your project.
Sure. And then even in that time thing, Chad, if the proponent doesn't give you enough time or can't give you enough time, then you on either the access side or the acquisition side have to understand, then how am I going to deal with this new condition that's added to my problem? So instead of going A, B, C, D, I have to go from A to D sooner, but I still have to do B and C. So that's why, just because he understands what the time difference is doesn't mean you're not going to have to adapt to a changing, time scenario.
How common is expropriation on projects like these?
Currently, it's very high. It's basically the tool. When I deal with owners, first of all, when you say expropriation, and I've given talks on this, is I show up a picture of a hammer because that's what people think expropriation is. It's a hammer, and in a way it is. And on the proponent side, it's the old Spock, Wrath of Khan, the needs of the many outweighs the needs of the few. That doesn't work either. So I think what expropriation is, you can't get away from it because without it, your projects could be delayed and could be a problem. So you have to turn it into a process. And I'm going through these explanations now, at these current times. And I'm basically saying, look, we're going to build a project. I didn't pick the project. I didn't pick the location, but the project's been approved. It's for the benefit of everybody else. So we, at some point in time, will expropriate. And here's why. But here's what that does for you. Because in Ontario, the Act provides protections for the owner. So we make sure that the owner understands how you're protected. And that, they cover legal fees and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, the job of the negotiator is to convince the owner that's saying, okay, once you've get them to accept the project, once the project is accepted, then we can go forward with compensation and access and all that other stuff. But you have to get that initial buy-in that, like it or not, this project's happening. That's not an easy thing to do, but once you do it, and then even when it becomes a process, I try to keep it with my owners that even though it's part of a statute or a legal process, that we continue to negotiate all the way.
Right.
Because it's the legal community does not make business decisions. So that still comes back to your organization and the negotiator.
Well, to your point, it's a tough message to get across. And again, I think it just comes back to the, being sensitive as that representative to the emotional component of that and focusing on the relationship. You're delivering some hard messages sometimes. It's not for everybody.
Well, that was my original thought at the beginning when I said, I thought maybe I should be an appraiser because I don't have to do that. So one of the things I don't like doing is going in to tell somebody we're taking their home. I really don't like doing that. It's very hard, but I will do it because I think I'm the best one to do it. And what it is that once we get through the initial shock, it is up to me to prove that we're going to do the right thing and deal with it. And that's, again, we're back to the relationship stuff. But if I'm going to have people whose homes have to be bought or removed, people have to be removed from their homes, I want to make sure I know who's delivering the message. I don't want it sent in a letter. I don't want it in an announcement. I want a personal face-to-face. And just a quick story on that. We went to see one guy. We had to take these two homes. And I said, are you sure? Because this is the toughest thing you're ever going to have to do. Is no, we have to have it. There's no way at the end of the world we have to have these two homes. So I said, fine. I told the engineer, you're coming with me to make the announcement. So I had them in there and I said, you know, we have to take the homes and so forth. But I brought the engineer so they can tell you why we need to take your home. Because that's a big question as to why. So by the end of it, it was getting a little, touchy in there. The engineer was starting to give away the farm. I was sort of have to knock the leg, and saying, okay, I'll take over from here. Let's not give away the farm. And so once the people accepted this was happening, then it was up to me to be there 24/7 if I had to be, to answer the questions, to do it, show progress, show the empathy or compassion. And the funny thing is, at the end of the day, after we had already had one of the owners find a replacement property, they came back and said, never mind, we don't need the houses. So that question going back was just as tough. So the party that had already bought another property, we said, this deal's going through. And we went to the other one and said, you have the option. We'll continue to do this or we won't. And, we'll pay you for your time. So, it just goes to show you that good news and bad news are interchangeable. Yeah.
Well, it's probably a bit of a process for a person, an individual, to get there in the first place, to accept that, okay, I'm accepting that I'm going to have to give up my home and find a new home. And just getting over that hump is hard enough to then have to go back to, oh, okay, I'm not.
Just kidding.
Neat joke. Yeah. I guess in closing here, what kind of advice would you share with either people that are in this field of work, doing the work that you do, or a proponent? What would be some final advice for either of those?
Well, for proponents, I would say don't minimize the value of the real estate input and work as a team, as an integrated team, because you'd be surprised at the experiences that somebody that's been involved in various types of acquisition can bring to a proponent when they're going to do certain things on projects. Just say, well, I've seen this before. You might want to think about this, because even if you're not a construction engineer, what you are is, first of all, most people in this business have enough of a personality, they're not shy. So that's number one. And number two, being in project meetings, you're not afraid to step up and be the alien in the room and ask the dumb question. And I think that's important. For people that are in the business now and are contemplating getting into business, just sit back and just think, first of all, how lucky you are to be involved in this type of work. The second thing is embrace technology, because it's really going to help you do your work. But never forget, it's the person-to-person relationship that will get things done. And that is what you really need, is don't hide behind memos or emails. If you've got bad news, face-to-face. Not letters, none of that. Get out there. If you got good news, face-to-face. And the one last thing is, if you're looking at a property, whether it's during COVID or not, go out and look at what you're dealing with. Do not look at satellites. Do not look at Google Earth. Do it on the ground. Because just the fact that you're out there is going to make a difference to that owner, and find something unusual. So when you go to the owner, say, I was on the property, I noticed you had one yellow brick and the red bricks, right? Just say, he must have been out there. Just find something to confirm that you did it.
That's great, Sandy. Where can people find you if they want to reach out to you to talk more about your experience and things you can do to help? Where would someone find you?
Well, I think you would just have to, you could do it through Google. I'm a strong member of the International Right-of-Way Association. You can find information there. You know, my information is, I don't know how you want that, Chad, if you have the information, if it can be posted somewhere. But in essence, if you check Sandy Gregg or any of those right-of-way LinkedIn, I'm on LinkedIn. And again, through the IRWA website as a member, Chapter 29 as a member. And I think if you really want to find me, just ask anybody that's sort of involved in this kind of business. And because we all know each other.
Yeah, you are well known in this industry. And so I would agree, we won't be hard to track down. We might include your email in the show notes that go out with the podcast, and people want, they sure can connect with you directly there too. So, well, Sandy, I appreciate you taking the time, share some of your background and experiences with us. And I look forward to continuing to learn from you and with you as we carry on with our access challenges.
Well, and I appreciate you doing this, because this is the kind of education that isn't found out there. Like the podcast, whether it's with me or somebody else in this business, I think this is how people continue to learn, get new ideas, and problem solve. So again, thank you, Chad. I appreciate the opportunity. And anytime, you know where I am.
Thanks so much for listening to Elevated Access, the inside story. I hope you'll join me again in 2 weeks' time for another great conversation with industry leaders in the energy and infrastructure space. If you enjoyed the show today, I'd really appreciate it if you subscribed and gave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. This goes a long way in helping other people find the podcast. If you've got questions, comments, or a suggestion for a future guest, please reach out to us at guest@elevated-access.com. Thanks again for listening. I'm Chad Hughes. Talk to you next time.